The Pat Kenny Show.
With the Jaguar E-Pace. Beautiful by design and dynamic to drive. Delivering performance that is unmistakably Jaguar.
This is News Talk.
Let's talk about COVID-19, because the numbers, and we were getting used to the old 6 o'clock thing, you know, there was 10, there was 14, there was 13. Everyone was going to try to interpret that as if we somehow were experts in infectious diseases. But then we all knew things had gone a little pear-shaped when on Friday there was 98, when on Saturday there was 174, and there were 68 cases yesterday. And we were warned that this was coming, because Ronan Glynn, who's the acting chief medical officer, did say, because of what's happening in meat plants in the three counties that are currently on temporary lockdown, that the numbers were going to rise because track and trace was working. Corina Butler, Professor Corina Butler, is an infectious disease specialist with Children's Health Ireland. She's on the line. Corina, good morning to you.
Good morning.
When you look at those numbers and you can see where they're coming from, are you happy enough that the track and trace system is having an impact and that we might be able to contain what's happening right now in Kildare, Laois and Offaly?
I would be confident that the track and trace system is having an impact, and witness that a lot of those that were detected in people who had not yet developed symptoms or were asymptomatic. But I don't know that we can be happy that we have it as perfect as we want it to be, because really what we want to get to is that anyone who has been in contact or has a risk factor has easy access to testing, that when they're offered the test, that they accept the test, and that the test result filters back very quickly. So I think we're seeing that a lot of that is happening, but I'm not sure, are we all the way there yet? I'm sure that work is still going on to improve the system even further.
Are you concerned, Corina, that somebody will be called for a test, they will take the test, but then they'll go back to work before the results of the test are through, for whatever reason that might be, maybe financial or lack of understanding of what's going on, or perhaps they feel they have to go back to work. Is that a big problem right now?
Well, I think we have a number of concerns along that pathway. First of all, we have concerns that people who are offered the test might not take it because they feel, well, it doesn't apply to me, or I don't need it, or they may perceive that there are downsides to the testing. So we have to give reassurance along all of those steps. Secondly, what you're saying, yes, may be a concern for people, particularly if they're out of work. And that's why we have to make every effort that the test turnaround time is very quick, so that it's only a matter of hours or at most a day, rather than being out for 2 or 3 days while awaiting for test results to come back. Because ideally, if somebody has been tested, yes, we would not like them to be in the workplace until they know what their status is.
But they, by all accounts, from what we heard, some of them were. And then the test came back as positive. I know of business owners who are worried about this as well, that they'll have staff who, for whatever reason, don't take it as seriously as others, or who might feel, I have to go in, otherwise I'm going to be down in my pocket. So should it be the case now that this is where we start to look at this at a national level and ensure that people are reassured that if they're waiting the results of a COVID test, they're not going to be out of pocket?
Well, I think that is a big consideration, not only around the testing, but around people who may have symptoms, who feel that because they are afraid of losing income and support, that they will continue to work through those symptoms rather than getting contact with their GP and arranging for a test to make sure that they haven't got COVID. So, yes, I think that is an important factor that needs to be addressed.
When you hear about the I suppose the mandatory mask wearing that takes place today, are you worried that there are still those within our society who feel that it doesn't apply to them? And reference what I was talking about earlier on, the men in particular, age between 20 and 45, who think that somehow COVID doesn't like them and is going to steer clear of them so they don't have to wear a mask.
I think there are a number of factors that have contributed to the confusion around masks. So in the beginning, definitely there was confusion and there was the perception that wearing masks generally wasn't really going to reduce the transmission, and that one didn't need to wear it unless you had specific symptoms. as the learning emerged, as we learned about this virus, as we learned about the impact, we know that wearing masks actually is a very important part of breaking that chain of transmission. But the emphasis then was very much on that you wear the mask to protect others. And some people felt, well, we don't really need to do that. I don't have symptoms. We don't need to do it. There's no benefit to me. And maybe there's downside. I'm uncomfortable. But what was a little bit lost in that message was we also wear the mask to protect ourselves. It is a two-way street. Yes, we prevent spreading droplets to others, and that's very important. But also, we reduce to an extent the likelihood that we will inhale droplets. And even if we're wearing a mask, and if by chance we manage to acquire infection, it's likely that the level of virus that we get will be less, and that consequently maybe the severity of the disease that we will have will be less. So it's a two-way street. There are benefits both ways. And in emphasizing the primary benefit, which is to stop onward spread, we've lost a little bit sight of that. So those are things that have contributed, I think, to the confusion and people feeling that the evidence really wasn't there. But over that time, there has been increasing evidence accumulated and now really quite solid that masks prevent droplet transmission. And it depends. Obviously, there is a gradation, and the three-ply or the two-ply masks are better than the bandanas that some people will choose to wear, but anything will block to a certain extent that onward transmission.
Well, they're better than nothing, and that's the basic science.
Absolutely.
Karina, can I just finish by asking you, obviously a lot of parents listening right now with their kids in the car, good morning kids, how confident are you that schools will be able to reopen and stay open in a couple of weeks?
Well, I'm a paediatrician first and foremost, and I am very, very conscious of the impact that COVID and the COVID restrictions have had on children. And I think we overlooked that because the disease itself is very mild and generally asymptomatic in children, and most children will fly through it. They won't have much trouble at all. But they have suffered in terms of that restriction of social contact, that restriction of learning, and other things in different areas. The stability that school gives with them, for some, school is often a place of safety as well as everything else. And so there is a huge burden, there's a huge risk to keeping children out of school. So what we have to really do is to make sure that the school environment is safe such that the children can go back to school, because it has to be a priority to get them back into school. Mm. And I think measures are being taken in as far as possible and as practical to ensure that that is the case. It will be, I think, a real tragedy if we see the numbers go up to the point where we cannot allow schools to open.
Okay.
And I think that's where it really comes down to all of us, individual responsibility to stop this in its tracks. And we know that we can do it, because
okay,
we saw it in lockdown, and we saw it in Australia now that with lockdown, that the levels are going down. So what that comes down to is breaking person-to-person spread. So social distancing, hand washing, the basics, and we can do this.
Okay, Professor Karina Butler, infectious disease specialist with Children's Health Ireland. Thanks for joining us. Pete Lawn is the head of the ESRI's Behavioural Research Unit. Pete has been keeping a very close eye on everything as this has evolved, because we are watching people's behaviours. We are watching how people interact with each other. There's enough science being produced right now, Pete, to keep you happy and busy for the rest of your career. But at the same time, we are seeing people becoming fatigued by this virus. You know, on a sunny day like yesterday or Saturday, it's hard to work out just where COVID fits into lots of people on a beach or trying to move around and just trying to get on with their lives.
Good morning, Jonathan. Yes, it's rather like living in a lab for the last 5 months or so, and it continues to be so. I do want to take you on about this idea of fatigue, though. Behavioral scientists around the world have been trying to knock this notion of behavioral fatigue on the head for all of that 5 months and failing, because it keeps bubbling back to the surface. And the reason I want to knock it on the head is this, that it's an analogy to kind of physical tiredness, that if we get physically tired, it is inevitable that we'll have to give up what we're doing or that we'll fall asleep. There is absolutely no inevitability that the huge behaviour change that Irish people and people around the world have gone through during this crisis necessarily has to come to an end because we simply give up and get tired of it. I mean, in fact, all of the behavioural evidence suggests the opposite, that we'll continue to be flexible, we'll continue to adapt, we'll continue to try to fight this virus as a community and as a society. So the notion of fatigue, that kind of analogy to physical tiredness, just is scientifically not right. Now, that doesn't mean we're not all sick and tired of the disease. Of course we are. You know, the disease is horrible and we're all sick of it. But I think what we'll see is we'll see people continue to be flexible and adapt and realize they're in a collective situation together, even if, as we try to squeeze a summer holiday out of things, we all end up on the same beach and it ends up awkward and difficult. Those mistakes won't keep being repeated. We will learn to adapt and we'll learn to do it better.
But at the same time, can we say with confidence that people are going to moderate their behaviours in the way we want them to, as was pointed out by Karina there?
Well, we have to be really careful. I mean, what we know about these kind of collective action problems is that what's absolutely crucial is the clarity of communication. If everybody understands why a behaviour is the best behaviour for all, so if we can all see why we need to do things in a particular way and that that's best for all of us, what usually happens in those situations, particularly at times of crisis, is a very large majority of the population will do what they should do. And we're seeing that happening now with masks. Of course, you know, you're getting a text message in telling you that only 2 out of 8 in a particular coffee shop are wearing masks. I mean, obviously, the people who've gone into coffee shops this morning and seen the large majority of people wearing masks are not going to send you a message. It's the one who sees not enough who's going to send you a message. What we can see in the tracking data is that mask wearing has just steadily increased over a period of a couple of months now and is now at a level where the large majority of people are complying. And I suspect from today onwards, that number will get even higher. And you can see that as that happens, I mean, I was in my local supermarket. Now it's the non-mask wearers who are looking around rather nervously, seeing who else is looking at them. And you can see the kind of social forces that are bringing about that compliance. Why? Because more and more people are understanding that this is something we just all need to do for each other. And when we get in those circumstances, what happens is that's what the large majority do.
There are people, Pete, who will feel very much isolated, and they're the ones in Kildare and Offaly and Laois right now, because they've got different rules to where I'm sitting in Cork or where you're sitting in Dublin. And it's arguably understandable that they're angry and that they want to lash out and they want to give out to somebody. How can we help rationalise that for them? Because they are very much at the centre of this storm at the moment.
Well, I think it's important to understand that to a very large extent, they're the victims of randomness and bad luck. And we need to be really careful here. We know from our own data that the Behavioural Research Unit at the SRI has recorded that there is a tendency for people to think that if the disease is contracted by an individual or a group of individuals, that they largely have themselves to blame. It's as if people have made a link between the idea that there are rules and behavior that will help you not get this disease. And if you get the disease, therefore, you haven't been following them. That's not necessarily true at all. The three Midlands counties, I mean, sure, you know, there's an environment there, particularly in these food processing plants, that clearly allows that virus to spread. But to a large extent, they're in the wrong place at the wrong time, and they've been unlucky, and they're the three counties that happen to have been hit from this. They deserve our sympathy. And the people who are caught up in this deserve our sympathy too. They certainly don't deserve blame and admonishment. But I'm fairly confident, I don't know, we've never been here before, but I'm fairly confident that they'll pull together. Counties have a very strong sense of identity in Ireland. It's a real bonus for fighting something like this. And I think people now understand what you've got to do. Your previous guest explained it very clearly. We know now that what you have to do if you're going to push these numbers down and get the infection rate down is adhere to some simple rules about reducing the risk. Each as individuals, all of us have to do it, and we all have to do it together to reduce the risk of transmission. And when we do that, the numbers start to go down. Now, we're in a situation where these counties have to do it as counties rather than as a national picture. But I don't see any reason why they can't.
If we keep having to do this again, right? So if you told me now that my county had to go in lockdown next, I know the psychological impact that's going to have on me. If, and God willing it'll happen, Kildare and Laois and Offaly come out of it in the next 2 weeks, and then sometime in October it has to be reimposed a third time, there will be real fatigue.
Well, we don't know that. I mean, you assert that with some confidence. I'm a behavioral scientist. I can't assert that with confidence at all. I mean, actually, the evidence that I've seen about how people respond to crises in the past, including crises about the spread of epidemics and disease, is that when people have to go through quite a lot of sacrifice and have to endure quite a lot of difficulty in order to suppress a disease, do you know what? They do it. And sure, let us hope that we don't have a third wave. Let us hope that that doesn't happen. But if it does, then we know what we have to do in order to get the numbers down. And we know what's on the other side of this. I mean, if we don't all act and we don't all act in the community interest to get these numbers down, hundreds, perhaps thousands of people are going to die. That's the situation we're in. And we can't deny it and pretend that that's not the situation. It clearly is. And I have every faith that what people will do in those circumstances, that they will recognize that and they will knuckle down and they'll do what they need to do. And sure, we are all sick and tired of that, but that doesn't mean we're going to stop doing it, because human beings are actually remarkably flexible and adaptive when they are in situations of crisis. And that is what we're in.
OK, Pete Lunn of the ESRI, stay with us if you can, please, because I want to bring in Roisin Shortall, who's on the line as well, the Social Democrats co-leader and TD for Dublin North West. Roisin, good morning.
Good morning, Jonathan.
When we talk about red lists, we've green lists and now there's a possibility of a red list. But we don't know how many people have actually been contacted when they arrive into this country from a country that isn't on the green list, asking them, are they staying in quarantine? We seem to have been particularly poor at that.
Well, the number is very low. I obtained figures just last week and other figures the previous week on this from the Department of Transport. And it seems that, for example, in the third week in July, people coming in through Dublin Airport, about 90% of those people were from countries that are not on the green list. So countries that are regarded as being high risk as a result of them having high rates of the virus. So that's a very large number, and we know that in terms of what was supposed to be a tracking process, because there's a requirement for people coming in to self-isolate and restrict their movements for 14 days, we know also that only about 7% of those people received a call from the Department of Justice, and only half of those
7%.
Actually answered the call. 7% of those people.
So 3.5% actually spoke to a human being who asked them, are you in quarantine like you're supposed to be?
That's right. And that isn't an effective system by any measure. And this has been a huge problem. I've been trying to draw attention to it for some time because, you know, when NPHET issued their advice, they do so in quite a lengthy letter that is subsequently published. They send that letter to the government. And one of the things that they have been highlighting now over a number of weeks is the potential threat that arises from international travel. And they've said that, for example, in the letter last week, they said about 8% of people coming in were found subsequently to have the virus. So 8% of the virus, sorry, I should push it the other way, 8% of cases of the virus relate to international travel.
Yes, but that's 8% out of all of those people who came here. So the risk is still relatively low. But the point is 96.5% of people who came in didn't speak to anybody about whether they were sticking to quarantine. And we have to be concerned about that.
We don't know anything about their movements. And, you know, in a situation where they're supposed to be theoretically self-isolating for 14 days, like, that system just doesn't work. And the Department of Justice, who've had responsibility for this, they've made it very clear that they don't have the capacity to do that, because as more travellers are coming in, they're required to do more work on the immigration front. So they have said they were waiting for the Department of Health to take over.
Oh, the old classic. You're chasing it around and around and around.
It's not their responsibility. It's the responsibility of the Department of Transport. So it is kind of past the parcel in relation to this very important area. And we note from today's newspaper reports that apparently now the Department of Transport are proposing to put in place a system, a call centre, so that there will be closer follow-up, we hope, of people coming into this country. But look,
Roisin, can I ask you a question about the idea of sick pay? And this seems to have arisen in some of the meat factories, that people who would have been tested, weren't feeling unwell, would have been tested, had to wait a couple of days to get the results back, went back to work, in the meantime, turns out they had COVID-19. We don't know why they went back to work. It could have been any number of reasons. But are you concerned that there may be some people out there who are afraid to say and stay at home and say, do you know what, I'm going to wait for the results of the test because they need the money?
Absolutely, Jonathan. I think this is a very big issue. And I think to a large extent, we do know why people take that risk. When we look at what's happening in relation to the meat factories, we know that a very high percentage of those people, about 95% of people working in those meat factories, do not have an entitlement to sick pay. Now, the work in those areas is extremely precarious. There were all kinds of reports coming in over the weekend about, you know, the way people were being paid, that they were being employed as sole traders. They were being paid through some convoluted system through Poland. It is a very unregulated area. It's very, very precarious work. And in those circumstances, you know, we shouldn't be surprised that people take risks and go back into work while they have symptoms or while they're awaiting a test result. And, you know, this is a huge area that has been highlighted. It was highlighted by the Dáil COVID Committee back in May. It, you know, many people have been drawing attention to it over recent months. And unfortunately, you know, the government still haven't got a handle on it. It is an area that is extremely unregulated. And that's why we need to ensure that there's proper action taken.
OK, well, we'll speak to the Taoiseach.
Not fair on those three Midland counties, on all of the other businesses and all the people resident there, if we don't have a proper system in place to ensure that.
Well, we'll speak to the Taoiseach about that in just a few minutes' time. Roisin Shortall, Social Democrats co-leader and TD for Dublin North West, thank you for joining us. I need to go to the Chief Executive of the Irish Refugee Council, Nick Henderson, who's been patiently waiting on the line. Nick Henderson, good morning to you.
Good morning to you, Jonathan.
You've been speaking to people who are in direct provision and living through COVID-19. The experience of them has been largely negative for all the reasons that we fully understand.
Yeah, we conducted a survey of people living in direct provision in April and May and the beginning of June. 418 people completed the survey and living in 60 different direct provision centres. And the feedback, as you say, is predominantly negative. People talking about the difficulties they have in socially distancing themselves from others. 55% of respondents felt unsafe. 50% of respondents were unable to socially distance themselves. 42% of respondents stated they were sharing a room with a non-family member. Some people talking about positively about being supported by some centre managers and staff. Others talking much more negatively. Two other things that on the positive, from a positive perspective, are that people seem to be getting enough information about the disease and had access to sanitizer. But overall, the theme is very negative.
And how concerned are you, Nick Henderson, that a lot of, and not, it's not exclusively direct provision workers, but a lot of, there would be a lot of crossover with low paid jobs, people who were in direct provision who couldn't work up until relatively recently but do work there now, and, say, meat factories. So if you have a perfect storm in a meat factory, then you have a perfect storm in direct provision, all of which was unnoticed to government.
Yeah, that's a serious concern. Another cohort of people is people who have worked in healthcare. The HSE took the very positive step in April of providing a temporary accommodation scheme so people could move out of direct provision if they were working in places like nursing homes to be safe. I'm actually not aware of too many people working in both a meat processing factory and direct provision. It tends to be different communities. For example, there are many Brazilian people who wouldn't tend to be in the asylum process who work in meat factories. The incidents in Kildare are obviously a concern, though, because that wasn't a meat packing factory. It was a dog food factory, essentially. So, yeah, it's a serious concern. And unless until people are giving the space to socially distance themselves from other people, there's going to be continued risk of direct provision being a hotspot.
All right, we'll leave it there. Nick Henderson of the Irish Refugee Agency, thank you very much for joining us.